day a rabbi. So I do the Virgin James. Minutes after day to Kai, from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made stronger by the hand of the Almighty. Say we forward in this generation, triumphantly, so won't you help to sing another song of freedom. Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourself from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our minds. Have no fear for atomic energy, and none of them can stop Japan. Cause how long shall they kill our prophets? Yes, we stand aside and look. Someone said it's just a part of it. We got to fulfill the book. So won't you help me sing another song of freedom? Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption.
Welcome to the Ferguson Response Network podcast. I'm your host, Leslie Mack. You're joining us for episode 14 of this weekly podcast devoted to supporting citizens working to create lasting social change through sustained civil disobedience and civic action. I'm joined, as I always am, by my awesome co-host, one Ricky L. Hines II. How are you tonight, Ricky?
Doing good. Much better than Monday.
Monday was a bad day for you. I was a little worried. I was like,
I was gonna fucking lose. I was gonna blow a gasket.
Anything involving like the road and cars and idiots, it's not a good combo. It just makes for everything.
An old entitled white guy.
That's the worst kind.
The Asian woman that hit me, she was perfectly, you know, she was like, hey, I'm sorry. We exchanged. It was quick. It was like 5 minutes, if that. And then entitled white guy, old white guy, decided to insert himself in my fucking face.
Like, what did it have to do with him? Like, why? I don't understand.
He was the manager of the parking lot, or it was his parking lot.
So?
But it's like, dude, we pulled into a fucking parking lot.
Right. To exchange info. What's it got to do with you? Mind your business. Ugh.
Yeah.
White people are the worst. And speaking of white people, we have one on the air with us. We actually have both halves of the Chonilla podcast, Chonilla Nation, the king and queen of the Chonillians themselves, Charlay and Clove are here. Hey, guys.
Yes. What's
Hola.
Going on?
Mm-hmm. Como esta?
And to talk about what you guys were saying, white people just like being heroes.
And test.
They're like
Mother
stepping
Nature.
In and being heroes.
And that's Mother Nature. It's true. Very true. If you are joining us for the first time, you can find the show on iTunes or Stitcher Radio. Just search Ferguson Response Network or go to our website, FergusonResponse.org. And if you have any actions coming up in your area, or if you're looking to find a Black Lives Matter action in your area, go to FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. If you don't know much about my illustrious, consistent co-host, Ricky, he's a Los Angeles native, U.S. Navy veteran, avid Googler, blogger. He's also a founder of the Americans United Again movement, and he hosts two other podcasts, the Americans United Again podcast, and with the lovely Sherelle, he's the co-host of AUA Hope podcast, which had a new episode that came out this week, which is freaking awesome. The podcast is so amazing. I don't know if you guys have heard it yet, Charlay or Clove, but it's devoted solely to positive news and stories, and it's like a breath of fresh air.
I'm just
gonna have to
listen.
Well,
I'm impressed with all the work that's being put in. Wow.
Wow. He's on his grind. And he's currently the
permanent.
Must own a club.
Yeah, he's also
The app, the Americans United Again app, is now available on the Google Play Store, too.
Oh, boy.
Yes.
Woo. Getting out there. And he's also currently co-hosting the Peniman Doctrine while Molly claims she's on leave. I noticed she was on the last show, too.
She's going through, withdrawals now.
She can't stay away. She can't do it. She can't do it.
Yeah, I'm still surprised. Like, she basically had, a titty anchor the entire time she did the show.
Well, she has a newborn, so she's feeding and podcasting. It's a good, use of time. You don't need your hands to podcast.
You don't?
No.
You don't.
No, you don't. No, you don't. And as for our two guests, as I said, they are the co-hosts of the Chonilla podcast, which you can listen to live somewhere thereabouts 9:30 on Friday evenings. It's my and Very White Guy's date night activity, usually on Fridays, is joining them for the show. And Shirley is a divom, which is a diva and mom of three. And of course, as I said, wifey, co-host, and blogger on the At Chonilla podcast, and which includes The Cackle and Mob Trial. Right? That's right. Mob Trial.
Yeah.
Awesome. Yeah. And she also has her own radio show on CKVL 100.1 FM in Montreal. It goes to the whole fucking island, you guys. You don't even know.
Well, oh, wow. The show, that has changed. It's no longer. That's why I support your community radio station, really. And that's for any community radio station. When you support it, helps shows like what I had to continue, or other great shows, too. Mm-hmm. But the show, like Chonilla and The Cackle, still gets played on CKVL, and then occasionally Clove and I host a show called Open Mic Night on CJD.
So full disclosure, CKVL was a local radio station for our area, and CJD was the full island of Montreal.
The full island
radio station.
Oh. Yes.
Yeah. So sometimes we'll occasionally, like I said, host. It's not Chonilla, but it's a completely different format.
Open mic with
open mic.
Chonilla.
Yeah.
With Chonilla. I love it.
Shit. Awesome. I mean, do you guys have clones?
Exactly.
I know. Right?
And when Clove is not busy falling and potentially injuring his orbital bone, he also works in a tech space, correct, Clove?
Yes, Clove.
Working at what? A tech space?
In the tech space, yes.
In the tech space, yes, that is correct.
Correct, Amundo. And
own club in the video game industry.
Ooh, that's even sexier. I love it. And Shirley is a self-professed social media fiend. That's right.
Yes.
So get on that. Absolutely. Well, unfortunately, as always, we have to jump into the news. We had some semi-late breaking news that you probably didn't hear about and wasn't on the information I sent you. I'm going to let Ricky take the reins and just update us on the situation regarding Floyd. What's his last name?
Ricky. Floyd Dent.
Floyd Dent. Thank you. All right, go ahead.
So basically, what happened to Floyd Dent is he... the nicest way I can possibly put this at the moment is that he had his ass whipped by 10 cops. Yeah. Basically, there were three cops that were caught on tape while seven other cops watched. He's from Michigan area. Mm-hmm. And I'll just go ahead and play the news clip from the incident. Because this actually happened January 28th.
Yeah.
If it'll play. Apparently Injustice is just finding its way on my damn computer.
Supremacy. It's everywhere. Let me see.
Literally.
I have it.
I can pull it up and play.
Oh, man. They jacked him up.
It's so bad.
Yeah, it's terrible. Here it is.
Yep.
You're looking at police dash cam video, a traffic stop of 57-year-old Floyd Dent, who is driving his Cadillac in the city of Inkster. When he's pulled over by police, he opens his car door. The situation immediately escalates and then turns violent. According to police reports and court testimony, Inkster police officer Melendez puts Dent in a chokehold and then delivers 16 blows to his head. A second officer, Zielinski, struggles to handcuff Dent. A third officer, Kritzers, runs up and tasers Dent three times, twice in the stomach, once in the leg. Several Michigan State police officers respond as backup and are also on scene. Police say they were protecting themselves. Dent says he doesn't know why he was pulled over or why he was viciously beaten.
Next thing I know, he officer runs up to me with his gun, you know, talking about blowing my head off. Then he grabbed me out the car, you know, and started beating on me. You know, I just couldn't believe it.
Police say they first saw Dent's car through binoculars. They were watching an area known for drug dealing. They followed Dent's car and say he did not properly stop at a stop sign. They say when they turned on their overheads, Dent did not pull over immediately, and they believe he was fleeing the officers.
When overhead lights came on, I looked, I said, wow, what the... Are you stopping me?
Dent says he did not try and flee, and the video shows he drove at a consistent speed until pulling over across the street from the old police station.
I had pulled over, and...
Okay, I think everybody pretty much gets the point.
Yeah.
Now, they actually charged him with...
to be clear, when you say him, you mean the individual that was beaten, just to be clear.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, because
no cops have been charged, and they're all currently still being paid by the state of Michigan, just to be clear on that, too.
Yeah. Now, the charges that were initially filed against him were possession of crack cocaine, or possession of cocaine, excuse me, a resisting arrest, evading the police, and attempting to fight the police, or assault. After looking at the video, a judge actually threw out most of those with the exception of the possession charge. He was found with no cocaine in his system when he was drug tested, so the likelihood of that actually being his is low, especially when you consider that one of the arresting officers has a pass with regard to planting evidence.
Ugh.
Mm-mm. And you know what? I'm looking at this video, and this guy was literally a tenth of a second away from being shot in the face.
Yep. Mm. Yeah. I mean, it's just getting to the point where I can't watch this video. I haven't even watched it. I don't know if I will. There's just a part of me, I've just stopped watching them because I know what happened, and there is such a traumatic, you know, response and trigger, and I have to kind of protect myself a little bit because it's just too fucking much. And I'm just seeing it now on Twitter, so I'm hoping that it starts to spread further, because I don't even know. I just don't even know. I'm sick of fucking hashtags. I'm sick of these goddamn cops. I'm sick of all of it. But
I'm sick of watching people get their ass beat on camera by police, or killed by police, and nothing happens. Like, people who sit up there all day and talk about World Star videos and how that shit needs to stop.
Mm.
Really? Motherfuckers in World Star videos are alive. You know, they have their dignity.
Well, ish.
Somewhat.
somewhat. They have what dignity they came into the situation with.
That's true. They didn't lose any additional dignity in the situation. Mm. That's very true. Yeah.
It makes no sense to me because I really thought, I guess, you know, trying to be hopeful or trying to see the bright side of things, you know, by nature for me or by default, that with everything that's been happening, you know, Michael Brown, Eric Gardner, everything, I thought, okay, cops are going to cool off a little bit, you know, like, okay, we need to really get our shit together.
I'm always
or cool off on just, it's just an, you know what I mean? Like mm-hmm. an automatic response. Like
I'm always thinking like I'm
but
left.
It seems to get worse. Sorry, go ahead.
It's okay. I always feel like I'm left hanging. Like I always feel like I'm like, I always feel like there's another question when all the information comes out. And now what happens?
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, and now what are we going to do about this?
Like how?
Like when are the police going to come out and say, you know what? Clearly, we have mistrained these individuals and we're going to fix this.
Or how many videos needs to be coming out? Like, does it have to get to the millions that legislation or that politics, you know, that the government starts stepping in and that we say, okay, there's clearly a problem with the police system.
Well, clearly there's a misbalance of culture.
Yeah. These guys need training.
Well, the thing is that
kicked off the force.
You could have a billion of these videos, but if the majority of people don't see this as a problem.
And they don't. Because all of these systems are so steeped in white supremacy, built on white supremacy, meant for these situations to occur, that it's very, you know, it's almost impossible for even the Ferguson Department of Justice report, you know, it's never going to name white supremacy being the heart of the racial bias that the people of Ferguson have been experiencing at the hands of their police force, because the Department of Justice itself is steeped in white supremacy and they're part of the system that needs to be broken down. And unfortunately, power is never given up without a fight. They're not going to just say, okay, you're right. Let's just go ahead and be nice now. Because it's not a matter of being nice. They honestly do not believe that black people have the right to breathe and live. And they think that they're better than us. And so they treat us as such. And that's not going to be something you can, unfortunately, legislate yourself out of. Ricky says all the time, he's like, I don't give a shit if you hate me and if you think that I'm worse than you are. It doesn't matter to me as long as it doesn't affect me, my livelihood, and my ability to live my life. That is where the problem is. You can hate me all you want to, but if it doesn't affect me and my life, then it doesn't matter. It's not about the feeling part of it. That's just, you know, whatever it is.
That's insult to injury, basically.
Right. It is. It is insult to injury, for sure. Speaking of insult to injury, we want to do a quick update on the Black UVA story, which was Martise Johnson's arrest and brutal handling at the hands of, I guess, the Alcohol Bureau of whatever in Virginia. You guys heard about that story. Did you guys hear about that story up in Canada?
About that college.
The college student.
Yeah.
Nope.
Okay, so a college student was bloodied in an altercation with police that are specifically only handling issues related to alcohol consumption and making sure that people are not underage drinking and things like that in Collegeville, Virginia, which is where UVA is. He's a third-year UVA student, and the video is really horrible. We played it last week, but I mean, you can hear him saying, you know, I'm a UVA student, you fucking racist, because there's just no reason for it. But coming out of that, the students at UVA basically started this hashtag, which is Black UVA Demands, and they started just saying, like, this has been enough. We've got to start talking about this issue. We have to do something about it. We're not going to stand for this. And Ricky, did you get to see the panel that they had a couple of days after the incident at UVA? It was on, it was live streamed. I watched it.
I didn't.
Members of the police department and members of the school, and also one of the, I think the deputy governor or something like that, a bunch of people called this panel. They didn't talk to any of the black students who had already started organizing. They had several rallies of the community there, and they didn't talk to the black student union, nothing that has elected officers to it. And they just held this panel, like, oh, we're going to hold this panel, which really is more of a press conference. And the black students on campus, they were not having it. They, first of all, bum rushed the stage. The four members that are president, vice president, and the other two leaders from the Black Student Union, and grabbed one of the mics and said, well, you didn't invite us here, but we're going to say what we have to say. And we're going to also stay on the dais. And you guys are going to have to hear us answer questions, too. and call them out for not including the people that are actually affected by this situation to discuss what was going to happen. And then they had clearly planned all the questions that were going to be asked. And anytime one of the people, one of the panelists would like try and skirt around the question or not get to not answer what they were saying, the entire room of Black students would raise their fists in the air and scream, "Answer the question you were asked." And I mean, awesome. They did it like 30 times in the entire panel. It was just brilliant, perfectly executed. And, you know, even the questions they asked, you know, they were the very last question they asked was, "Can anybody on this panel tell me exactly what happened to Martise on Tuesday night?" And they were like, "No." Okay. And then everybody walked out. Here? Saying Black Lives Matter, and they were like, they left. When they all left, I think it was like three people left in the auditorium. I mean, it was just brilliant.
Yeah.
And then coming out of that panel, a new hashtag came up, which was not just UVA. And so it's been a lot of college campuses that have been organizing and also sharing the stories that are similar to not just, you know, the brutality that Martise experienced, but just the experience of being a minority on a college campus and what that is like and what the institution, these institutions treat their Black students like and the Black community there. And for me, it's been incredibly triggering. I've really been like trying to piecemeal even looking at the hashtag too much because it's so familiar to me. I went to an elite boarding school for high school. I went to, you know, they would call themselves elite university that was, you know, more than predominantly white. There was hardly any Black people there at all. And so many of the stories, it was like, oh, I remember that happening to me. Oh, that happened to me too. Just like, you know, just all of the indignities that you suffer and you don't realize it till you look back and remember them. And you're like, oh, that was so fucked up. Like at my high school, I think my graduating class was like 90 something and there were maybe 10 Black girls in my graduating class. We were all pretty close, as you can imagine, and away from home and all that. So we always sat together. And I mean, I can't tell you how many times that administrators would say, "Why are you all sitting together? That's so racist." Like, wow. Meanwhile, there's international students at the school and all the Korean students would sit together. Nobody thought anything of that, you know, all of those things, just specific anti-Blackness. And it just really is so hurtful, especially at those younger ages where you're forming your psyche and your self-worth. And it's just the worst. And what do Canadians like think about all of these things that are going on in the United States right now? Like, what is the impression you guys had? I mean, I'm sure you didn't have a very good impression of us previously. We're loud, we're obnoxious. We have too expensive healthcare and, you know, it costs billions of dollars to come have a baby here by accident if you're Canadian and all of that. But I feel like, you know, what's the temperature been like since, you know, August 9th when Mike Brown was killed and all of this unrest is going on? What is the thought? What are you guys thinking about?
For me, it's funny because I had a guest on another show and we're just talking about that. And she's not Black, but she's from Spain and she's biracial. I can't remember what her father was, but anywho, in Canada, it just feels as a person of color who's a minority. It's shocking because it's like there's a lot of feelings like, wow, this is crazy, especially with this whole, you know, you have Obama who's your president and you would think that something like this would just not happen. And the way that it is now, at the same time as Canadians, and I was talking to other people, it's brought a sense of awareness to this does happen in Canada, but in a different way. It's much more, it's kind of like bringing out slowly discussion to let white people know that stop being in the closet. Because race and racism here in Canada is very closeted.
Mm.
You know, people are going to smile at you, and you know, you could get that promotion or a job or whatever, but you can only go so far or so high in the chain, mm. I guess.
Mm-hmm.
But deep down inside, as a minority in Canada, you know, there's just this sense of, I know when I turn my back, I would not be surprised that one of my colleagues have said something really ignorant to each other at work while I'm not there or in the comfort of their home. You know, mm. People are, you know, one of the guests that we had, we were talking about, you know, she was actually asking me about our show and what's our show about. And I mentioned the whole interracialness, but, you know, our show doesn't really, it's not the focus really.
Right.
You know, that it was just a, anywho. And at the station where we, you know, occasionally host sometime, we had a guy and I was explaining to him what Chonilla is about and everything. And he was a white middle class, like middle-aged man. And told him the meaning of the name. And he said, well, you know, it's not a big deal anyhow, this whole interracial thing. That's like a U.S. thing. They're all obsessed about that. Here in Canada, it's not a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
And it made me think, I was like, yeah, I hear what you're saying, but I bet you, maybe someone in your family, if your sister or your brother or somebody brings someone of another race in the home, that's probably when the issue happens. And that's what I feel it is in Canada.
Mm.
No, everybody's going to be like, yeah, this is great. And we get along and it's all good. But when you bring that home, mm-hmm. it's a whole different,
when you breach that private area.
Right. Yeah. It's a whole different thing. And that's how I feel in Canada. It's very closeted. If it comes into my door, that's when there's a possibility that it's a problem.
Gotcha.
As a white Canadian, it's been really eye-opening for me. I think there's a lot of things that was happening in Canada that I just wasn't able to see through that layer of privilege.
Mm.
And the escalation. Well, the feeling of escalation, because I'm convinced that the level and intensity that this is happening at has been always happening like this. It's just the ability to bring it onto the social forum is only now available. And
right.
having that kind of like the thing drawn out for you, you can't help but relate it to your immediate environment. And that's what started happening. Yeah. I started to notice the racism was, okay, surely...
Closer than you thought?
Oh, yeah. Closer and a lot more abusive mm-hmm. and a lot more systemic than I thought.
Systemic, yeah. Passive... It's very... Race here in Canada is super passive-aggressive, mm-hmm. I find. Mm-hmm.
Which can be so psychologically damaging, too. Like, it's almost like there's a gaslighting nature to that kind of racism.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very, you know... When it's inflicted on you, it's very hurtful. And that's mm-hmm. what you saw in these Not Just UVA tweets, was a lot of that, where it was like, you know, the students were made to feel like they were, you know, crazy for feeling
right.
this
you're,
way.
You're taking a crazy pill, right?
There's things now that I'm more, like I have my ear to the ground a lot more, and especially with the language people are using. Mm. And mm-hmm. and especially with a lot more awareness that we have of what's going on in the Native community and how neglected they are as a populace in Canada.
Mm-hmm. It's ridiculous.
So, but that's stuff that you just, you know, like you have to be looking for it, because right. in Canada, it's so easy to avoid that stuff. It's so easy because everybody has this outwardly perception of getting along that you can get along and not witness any of this stuff.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? But if you're looking for it, then you'll see it.
You
will see it plain as day.
Really,
it's just easy
closely.
To look away from it in Canada.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Yes, it is. I mean, I lost my train of thought.
Quick question. Is it wrong that I guess this is how like underprivileged black people are in America. That I'm hearing this shit and I'm like, wow, that doesn't seem so bad.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck is wrong with my life that I?
Ricky's like, wait. Yeah.
But you know what though? I honestly think that people, that Canada has a history of being of two things. Having many of the same problems that America has, just in a much more passive aggressive way. So, you know, we have blatant open white supremacy here. You guys have passive aggressive white supremacy. And then you guys also happen to learn from our mistakes like 10 years later. And sometimes we learn from them and other
most
times
of the time we don't.
Fucking don't. We don't. Yeah, I mean, think about it. The national health care. We have been talking about since the fucking early 20th century.
Yep.
Mm. DOMA was signed in 96. Canada legalized gay marriages in what, 2005?
Yep.
I mean, it's just like, fuck, every time we screw something up, they're like,
In Canada, we're like, what can we learn from this? Maybe it's
yeah.
It's really.
Yeah, if only we actually did the same thing.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting you say that because you made me think of a whole bunch of stuff. And you're absolutely right. When it's really hot and heavy in the U.S., it makes your neighbors, your cousins up here, start thinking,
It's also made me weirdly hyper aware. Where, like, we'll be in situations and I'll look to Shirley and I'll be like, that was fucking racist, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, there definitely is that.
It's crazy when you finally see the shit. It's like,
oh my God. I can't describe how night and day it is. Yeah. I can't describe how it's like.
It's like the Matrix.
Yeah.
Yes.
Exactly.
He took the other pill.
Exactly.
The
red pill.
And it's literally like hearing that record skip, like, way more than ever before.
Yeah, I mean, you just had an experience at work. We're not going to, I don't know, we can't go into details.
I cannot talk about that.
No. Right. But you've experienced something where you're like, oh my, are you serious?
This is not happening right now. But the thing is like 2-3 years ago.
You'd be oblivious.
I would have been like, okay.
You'd probably like chuckle.
That's a joke white people say when they're hanging out.
Yeah. And right. I find like the younger generation, maybe it's living in Quebec. That's another thing, too.
French Canadian.
Yeah. Quebec is like the Texas of Canada.
It is a special province.
Really? but it made me think about... Shit, I lost my train of thought again. Oh, right. Ferguson, going back. I think seeing what the U.S. is experiencing with just everything with Black Lives Matter, Ferguson and all that. The biggest conversation I'm noticing with people of color, like basically non-whites in Canada, it's waking us up to see, you know what? Although we're a mosaic, there's a sense of melting pot mosaicness in Canada, which is true. You know, it is there, mm-hmm. But it's making us start thinking like it's not perfect. I mean, let's look at our government. We're mm-hmm. not represented. Let's look at it. It's the conversation is like that is happening in Canada. Like, okay,
that's great.
You know,
I have a question for black people.
We need to start stepping in and being more visual and demanding a little bit more, you know, moving up the ladder mm-hmm. in the corporate world and being on television or radio or yeah. any form of entertainment. So that's what I'm finding is happening.
The Native community, too, is being a lot more outspoken. Mm. And
you have inspired the Native community, like, in
big time. Yeah.
Because...
And there's...
it's crazy for them.
Yeah, there's a documentary called The Eighth Fire, and it talks about that this was somehow, like, predicted within Native culture that there would come a time where there needs to be a renegotiation mm-hmm. of the what was agreed upon beforehand, like the conversation needs to happen
about the treaty.
Exactly. Mm. Yeah, like they're owed literally an insane amount from the whole Canadian government, and I think that obviously that's the resistance to sit at that table.
Yeah, for them shut down right? Canada.
So I have a question. And Leslie, you mentioned that seeing through and seeing the racism is kind of like seeing into the Matrix. And I was wondering, like, what is it like for a black person to finally see that? Like, because I'm guessing that a black person could be raised within that system, just accepting it for it is what it is.
Yeah, I mean, for me, it's been.
You have to.
Yeah, it's been more of a coping mechanism.
You have to.
Yeah, you have. It definitely is a point of, and for me, it's been much more of a, you know, yeah, I'm not really willing to take your bullshit anymore, and I'm not really. I actually wrote an argument with somebody in my church, my old church, and he had emailed me literally like 4 weeks ago, and I had waited all this time to respond because I was just like, you know what, I didn't want to. I was putting it off, and it basically, you know, came down to me just saying to him, "It's like, you know, I'm not going to allow myself." To respond to you in a way that's acceptable for you. I'm not going to only view myself through the white gaze any longer. And so that's really been the shift. It's like, it's not just seeing things differently. It's like seeing myself differently. It's like, no, I'm not going to allow you to silence me. I'm not going to make this more palatable for you. I'm just not going to do it. And that has been, you know, it's changing because I've changed, but it's also changed because, you know, people around me have started to treat me differently because of it. But that's okay, you know, because really, I can't really be around those kinds of people anymore, generally speaking. It's not good for me. And so that's the point where I just feel like a lot of, you know, black people are just like, you know, it's enough already. It's just enough. Okay. And that's the part that I think is difficult for white people to quite understand. Like, they're so used to us trying to make things palatable for them, to put it in a way that they'll be able to still feel good even though they hear it. And it's right now that we're done with that part of the conversation, the part where you get to ignore the hurt that we are feeling, that you get to deny that you're benefiting from this incredibly racist system that we live under. It just, it's not going to happen anymore. So that, to me, that's been the biggest shift. It's not even been about me seeing things, because I have always seen them. It's hard not to, but I also allowed myself to, you know, think it was okay to not make people feel bad about it happening. Right. And so that barrier has been, you know, completely shattered. And it's kind of like what the Black Lives Matter movement is about. Because if you believe that Black Lives Matter, it's like, then everything that I have to say matters then. And you don't get to say what that's about. And it's very, you know, it's about confronting these areas in almost every aspect of American life that this supremacy seeps into, you know, organizationally, our religious institutions, certainly our education system. I mean, it's everywhere. So you really do have to kind of like look at everything with that gaze upon it and root out all of these ways in which it manifests itself.
Yeah. And any comment that isn't passed, any comment or opinion that isn't passed through that whitewash filter is seen as like aggressive.
Yeah. It's an attack. You're attacking me.
Yeah.
Which,
like, whoa, 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 whoa.
What are you getting so upset about?
I think another big part of it is just having to deal with the fact that it's kind of like having to deal with the fact that someone's pissing on your head 24/7.
Mm.
You wake up, when you go to sleep, doesn't matter. Someone's pissing on your head. You either make the conscious decision to control life as much as you can and blame yourself whenever something goes wrong. You know, whenever you get piss in your eye, oh, I should have been wearing a hat and a raincoat. That you not wearing a raincoat isn't the problem. It's the piss. You have black people, honestly, you can't think about it, even though you know it's there. And every once in a while, every once in a while, you'll lose it, but it's frustrating. It is beyond frustrating. There's no other way to really put it.
The reason that I asked that question is because I remember that that Fresh Prince episode where they get pulled over, you know, driving while black, and they go to jail, and and Carlton finally sees that, you know, there's this racism going on. You know what I mean? And to him, it was like, what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I can't even imagine what that would be like.
No, for sure. And it's something I talk about all the time, you know, when I talk about respectability politics, this idea that you can, you know, that your resume will help you, or your education will help you, or the way you dress will save you. It's none of those things are bulletproof. So it's very dangerous to put that idea out. And you could hear that in the video of Martise being beaten up, where he's screaming, I'm a UVA student. Yeah. He's saying I'm a UVA student because he even, you know, on some psychological level thought that that was something that was going to stop this from happening to him. Mm-hmm. And it's heartbreaking to hear him, his voice break when he says it over and over again. I'm a UVA student. I'm a UVA student. Why? And then he starts to say, why is this happening? Jesus. Why is this happening?
Yeah.
Because he can't believe it. Because a second ago, he was just trying to get into a bar as a college student. And now he has three cops around him. His entire face is bloody. He had to get 10 stitches because they slammed him into the pavement. And you hear the police officer say, stop resisting. Literally, their quote unquote resisting was him saying, I'm a UVA student. I'm a UVA student. He's not even moving. So it's like, you know, it's a surreal kind of realization. It's like, yeah, that could be you. And you shouldn't give anybody the impression that it couldn't be. And the sooner all of us fucking realize it, the better. Because it's like, I don't know how many more reports need to come out, which the Philadelphia Department of Justice report came out today. And, you know, not surprising. None of the reports are surprising. These were specifically looking at officer-involved shootings. And, you know, every goddamn statistic is just confirmation of everything. Black suspects were more likely to get shot because of a misidentified object. Half of the time that officer used their gun, they mistook a non-threatening object for a gun. 49% of the time. And most of the time it was a black person. It was either a cell phone or somebody just touching their waistband. Literally. 49%. 49%.
Yeah. It's insane. And then the law, these cops continue to work. They don't pay any consequence whatsoever. So it makes others that sees this going on to just, it just perpetuates. It just makes it okay for them to continue this bullshit, to continue, you know, their racist bullying ways of just like, hey, you know what? I'm having an off day. It's kind of a slow night tonight. You know what? Let's do a stop. Uh-huh. See if we find a young black man or any black man and just, you know, take out our steam on these guys. And
it's so crazy how direct that sounds,
and we're not going to be punished for it because the law's on our like,
and they've already done it like 100 times up until that time.
The law is on our side, and they know it.
Mm-hmm. That's that and that's that noble cause corruption, right?
Oh my goodness,
it is. It's so.
And you know what's even more telling though about the study or about the report,
the DOJ report
where they write, we also examine the race of involved officers in a threat perception failure, officer-involved shootings to gain greater understanding of how cross-race encounters may influence threat perception. We found that the threat perception failure for white officers and black suspects was 6.8%. Black officers had a threat perception failure rate of 11.4%, and the threat perception rate for Hispanic officers was 16.7. They are outsourcing white supremacy.
Yeah, no doubt.
It is white supremacy is not something that that is just the practice of white people.
No, it's not. It is a systemic wave in which these things occur. A system continues without any help from anything or anybody. It goes on its own. Yeah. And so this is about a culture that is anti-black and anti-color. And so this is what you see. Out of the 382 suspects involved in shootings, this is between 2007 and 2013, 88 of them were killed. Mm. Okay, 88 of them were killed. During that same time, exactly six officers were shot, were injured and one was killed in encounters with suspects.
Oh my God.
So it's like
more to fear as a
their
civilian.
Their fear is so unjustified on so many levels. It's just like insane. It's insane. I think we even mentioned it either on this show or on Interracial John. Like when the first officer was killed this year, I think we had already had like 100 killings by police officers already by that time.
Wow, that's
it's very, very rare in most even large urban cities for a police officer to be killed, and certainly not by a gun. They die. Sometimes they have a heart attack or it's a car accident or all sorts of other things, but not with a gun. That is the least likely way that a police officer is killed. That's we're not idiots. You're already fucking killing us unarmed. You think we're going to just shoot at you? It doesn't even make sense conceptually, unless you honestly believe that black people are stupid. And they do. And that's what the problem is. So I went to the Amnesty International General Assembly this weekend. And it was it was in my hometown of Brooklyn, New York. And so it was really kind of a no-brainer for me. I had hesitated to go because, honestly, Amnesty International is like the whitest organization on the planet. And I was kind of like, ugh. But I did see a lot of they had a lot of Ferguson protesters and Black Lives Matter movement leaders that were there. And so I was really, you know, excited to meet all of them. And, you know, we've already interacted online in other spaces. So it was really amazing. And to go to all the sessions that they were involved in. Of course, as I mentioned that, you know, Amnesty is an incredibly white institution. It was like the white privilege was like on beyond fleek. It was like I hadn't been around that much white privilege in a long, long time. You know, just like roomfuls, like ballroom size roomfuls of white people congratulating themselves for their human rights work and their Americans. Oh, it was like, you know,
was it thick enough to taste?
Feel it. It was thick enough that the black attendees and the black employees at Amnesty International had to create their own caucus space on Saturday night to discuss the fact that it was that bad. That's how bad it was.
That's like the
basically you guys were choking.
Yes, we need a space because we can't even fucking breathe right now in this. It was palpable. And, you know, they have hired some very high profile Ferguson protesters. They hired Netta. They hired Larry Fellows as well to work for them full time. And it's been, you know, a bit of a struggle. You know, they hired them and then they started like sending them random places and asking them to focus on everything but the thing that they were supposed to be working on, in their opinion. And, you know, at the caucus meeting on Saturday night, you know, employees from Amnesty, black employees were crying about what a caustic environment it is, how they're not listened to, that these white people in this organization believe that human rights is about going to China to free dissidents and go save farmers in Peru and turn a complete blind eye to the human rights that, violations that are happening in their own cities, in their own country, on their own soil, and the white supremacy that they've allowed to fester within their organization. I mean, it's really fucking disgusting, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, that's the epitome of privilege. They really, really, really can't see it.
Now, do you think there'll be a day when there's an awakeness where white people, the majority, would just say, okay, We gotta stop this whole privilege system.
I think there'll be
just equally live amongst ourselves as human beings. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. We're equal. Like, let's stop doing the whole creating a system that just it's all about advantage us, and let's just create a system where it's everyone has an advantage.
Do you know when that'll happen, Shirley?
Do you think it'll ever happen, or it's just human nature? Because let's say the roles were reversed. Black people were the majority. Would we have done the same?
I'll tell you when it's going to happen. It's going to happen when money makes it happen. Mm. It's going to happen when the corporations adopt a philosophy that transcends us and them and sees the power in us. That's the only time it's going to happen. The corporations are going to drive that, and it's the people growing up and being born now who are going to run those corporations. So you're seeing way better corporations when it comes to the human connections out of corporations like Google.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? So that's still going to evolve. And when they start to see that they can tackle racism head on and improve the relationship of their the workers in within their walls, they'll do it.
Well, I think that that has to come with a caveat, because there have to be laws and policies in place that incentivize them doing so. Because even a company like Google, who does who does a lot of social advocacy, they're making money hand over fist over white supremacy, and they have really no financial incentive to stop it.
Right.
You look at say a Paul Allen, who invented Microsoft, co-inventor of Microsoft, and how he can basically give $100 million to Ebola. But the reality is, had he just paid his had he paid a fraction of a percentage more in his tax bracket, he would have paid maybe about five or six times that. That would have went to the government and then could have been filtered back down to fight Ebola.
I mean, the thing is that I don't know how if white people will ever wake up to that. I have my doubts. Like I say all the time, you know, if we're waiting for the moral compass of white people in America to kick in, we'll just be waiting forever. We've already been waiting. So
well,
I don't
have to agitate it.
You know, you have to put this pressure on and make people uncomfortable. But I think there's going to come a point where there's a few things that are going to be very difficult for white America to face. And the biggest thing for me, especially with white men, is that they're going to have to come to the realization and come to terms with the fact that they're really not very impressive. Like they have this idea that they're so exceptional and they're so, you know, they're so smart and they've gotten where they are because they're so great. And it's like you being successful is the least impressive thing ever. You being successful is what everything is built for. So it's not impressive at all. You're not special. You just happen to be able to do those things because you have all the opportunities and ability to go and do them. And so until I would imagine that it's going to be a very difficult thing to confront. Because really what they're going to be confronting is, you know, the truth about themselves and everything that they've chosen to believe about themselves is in direct contrast with reality.
I think
is going to, you know, you talk about COVID, about money. I think it's just going to be nature that's just going to force this moral shift. Really. I don't know if it's, I don't think it's going to be money. I don't think it's, you know, corporation. I think it's just going to be mother, like just nature itself. If more minorities really, it's two things, either gather up, you know, like, I mean, can you imagine like one day that every single non-white culture gathered up and say, you know what, this is fucking bullshit.
Right.
Enough is enough.
And you see that happening. You know, it's definitely something that you're seeing. And I do think it's, you see it happening so much faster. You know, when Anthony Hill was killed in Madison, I remember the response from the community was so fast. So fast. I it was lightning speed. I couldn't believe how quickly they had a location, a time, and everybody was out there. And it was the same thing with UVA. You know, it was like, nope, we have to do something. When you see middle schoolers walking out in protest from their school, you're like, okay, 7 months ago, that would have never happened. Ever. Nobody would have thought that was something you could even do or that there would be a purpose to that. So, you know, it's definitely been a shifting of sand here. You know, these are things that presidential candidates are going to have to answer questions about. A year ago, nobody would have been asking anybody that these questions.
It'll so be interesting.
It's going to be really interesting. So what came out of the caucus meeting on Saturday at the GA in New York was the decision to actually do an action during the final plenary, which was on Sunday afternoon. Drew actually joined me for the second day of the conference, so he was in the room with me during the action. And so this was a panel on sustaining and growing our movement. And after the panelists, one of whom was Rosa Clemente, who used to work for Amnesty International, was fired due to a lot of the same issues that were discussed on Saturday night. Erica Totten from D.C. Got up, and let's play what happened.
All right. So what I wanted to say, too, and I'm glad that you called that out because that was really funky. And so I was excited when I came. My name is Erica Totten. I'm an organizer and activist in D.C. and in Ferguson and a lot of different areas. But I'm all about accountability. And when I heard your experience, Rosa, about being in this organization that did not affirm your leadership and did not agree with how you went about Black liberation work, is a problem for me, because now we have this message of bringing human rights home, and we know that the movement in this country is Black Lives Matter, and we know that this country is based off and built off of white supremacy, so Black liberation work has to be the focus of your organization. Mm-hmm. There is no question about it. But you cannot tell Black people how to get free. So you have to have spaces, create and give up your privilege and give up your power to people who are directly affected by this and know how to do it better than you, because we live it.
Thank you.
So you have to give that up. And so ultimately, with this, the reason why I am saying this, because it's connected. I have brothers and sisters that are in this organization that were directly such impactful voices in the Black Lives Matter movement, and now that they're here, we will be holding Amnesty International, Amnesty USA, whatever, we will be holding you accountable. This is my first time really understanding you all, because I saw you as a white organization that really did not do anything for Black people in this country. So we have demands. The first one is from the movement right now, because if you're taking the narrative, we will be holding you accountable for what you say you will do in this country. And so the first demand is all board members, executive staff, and all managers must go through a continued series of trainings and establish accountability and performance measures on equity in the workplace, including but not limited to racial identity development, white middle class dominant culture in the workplace, and anti-racism training. That's demand one. Demand number two, put Black people in managerial positions within Amnesty that focus on Black liberation work in the United States with resources equal to your work in other countries. Fully funded. Demand number three, create satellite Amnesty offices in U.S. cities where Black liberation work is happening right now. Don't come into our movement, take our people, remove them from their community, and then have them focus on Jordan and Syria when Black people are dying right here in this country. It's psychologically violent to pull someone out of their own movement and say, and sell them a dream and say, this is what you're going to do, and then flip the script on them, our main voices in the movement, and you tell them, I need you to focus on these five other states that have nothing to, it might be things going on there, but where their home is, where people are dying right now, you are taking them away and you are putting them in other areas, and it looks like COINTELPRO. That's what it looks like, because that's what happens. You take our best and our brightest, and you dim their light. You crush their spirit with racism in your organization. You take their power, and they feel powerless, and they forget who they are. And we are the ones that have to end up holding them up, and holding them up with their spirit, and pouring back into them. And it's exhausting. So we will be holding you accountable. We will not allow you to break our people and steal them from us, because they are too important. So if you are saying that you are bringing human rights home, we are holding you accountable. And these are our three demands, and they better be met. Woo! Because you know we shut it down. No question about it. Those are our three demands. If you have questions about anything, I'm more than willing to have a conversation. But we will be, and I'm talking about all of us in the Black Lives Matter movement.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So, wow. So that happened. After Erica was done, there was some chanting. You know, we did, if we don't get it, shut it down. And then the Asada quote from everybody kind of got together and did that. You know, it's our duty to fight for our freedom. It's our duty to win. We must love and support each other. We have nothing to lose but our chains. And then almost everybody that was black left. I actually stayed. Dre stayed. Drew stayed with me because I really wanted to see what was going to happen in the room after, as you heard, such a powerful show of strength and support for change in this, within this organization. It was really uncomfortable. I have to say it was pretty uncomfortable after it happened. And then they announced the next person who was going to speak. And she got up and she made a speech about something they call a get on the bus, which is get on the bus for human rights. It's a human rights and activism kind of arm of Amnesty. And so she was talking about what they were going to be working on for 2015. And she named four main actions and five side actions, none of which took place in the United States.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
And then we were all kind of outside mulling about outside, talking to people afterwards. And the director of, I think her title is Director of Member Engagement, because they posted the three demands. And as Erica was reading them, an individual walked in front of the stage with the demands written on a very large sheet of paper. I tweeted a photo of the three demands. The director of membership engagement said, and I'm quoting her here, "I can't deal with these people and their demands," end quote.
Oh my God.
Fuck. So, yeah.
Does it feel, and again, that's coming from someone who is from the outside. Like, I'm, you know, I don't live in the United States, mm-hmm. so. It seems like for me, looking at the outside, like, was there like this presentation that the United States was showing the world, like, look, we're actually blending more and things are getting better, in, you know, when it comes to race and culture and everything like that.
Mm.
And then something like Ferguson or even Trayvon.
Right.
Kind of open a door where it's like, no, this was all a lie? Or was there this sense that in the United States, for someone who is not white, that a sense of like, we were delusional, that we thought maybe things are getting better, but this is kind of like a punch in the face that no, it's not.
And honestly, I think that happened January 22nd, 2009, when we figure out, holy fuck, like we were dreaming. And that's the day Obama was inaugurated.
Yeah.
Right.
It was like, holy shit. Like, why does he need so much security? Oh, fuck, he's black. God damn it. And it was like, holy fuck, why are they treating him this way? Yeah. Oh, fuck, he's black.
Yeah.
Damn it.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's been happening and ramping up ever since.
The only
solace that I'm going to take from Hillary being our president, which, given everything that's going on, looks like it's the most likely outcome, is that just like it showed America how just like Obama being president showed America how racist we are and reminded us, her being president will remind us just how sexist we are, yeah, how misogynistic.
Yeah.
That's the only solace that I can take from it, because I weep for the fucking policies she's going to put in place.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's been... I mean, I would say if Drew was here, he would probably say yes, it was an awakening, even though he's been married to a black person for, you know, almost 20 years. I think that he would say, you know, it was an awakening because, yes, I think we had all lulled. And I'm older than Ricky is, so I'll speak from somebody that's a little bit older that... You know, people my age, mid-30s to mid-40s, I would say that we allowed ourselves to think that things were getting better. And when I talk to people that are around my age, I hear them say, you know, things like, well, our parents didn't talk about civil rights in our house, really. Mm-hmm. We didn't talk about race because they, you know, they were raised in a very violent environment with regard to race. And so we had a much better than them. And so in their minds, you know, things were getting better, especially if they have been able to be upwardly mobile in their lifetime. Yeah.
Here's what I think needs to happen. And I think this needs to happen in Canada as well. I think that when you are elected and you represent, or you basically represent the power structure that has put you in place. You're elected president. There's a system there and you got through it. Now, what I'm saying is that the president or the prime ministers, like the top guys, what they should do is they should allow minority groups to elect a representative for them to sit at the same table for every decision that gets made by either the prime minister or the president. So that way, every group feels that they have representation. And not only that, but then when the decisions are delivered, they are delivered as they've all agreed to this decision. And this is why.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great idea on the legislative side of things. But I mean, for me, you know, there's been too much ability for white people to act as though they aren't complicit in the situation that black people are in right now. You know, like, you white people in America stood by when and said it was okay to tie education funding to income. Mm-hmm. You did that. You said that it was okay for your kids to go to a good school while black children went to bad ones.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was something that you were okay with. Mm-hmm. And you continue to be okay with
it. You were okay with cutting the top tax rate from, was it damn near, what did Reagan cut it from? 67 to 40?
To 40, 45? Yeah, 45, yeah. You know, you were okay with that. So to me, it's like there has to be a reckoning. And that's also part of the piece that I think white people are very uncomfortable with, is that black people are here in this country. We're just not here for the bullshit anymore. And we're just not here to allow you to say that, you know, oh, I didn't mean it, or this was not my fault, or I don't have a part to play in this. Because you do have a part to play in this, and you have had a part to play in this, and you cannot continue to deny that that's been occurring. And that's what each of these police, you know, the police brutality part is just one arm. Yeah. We're seeing it there first because it's the most, you know, physically detrimental. But this is something that's everywhere. You know, I'm talking about probably, you know, everybody in the room at the Amnesty International General Assembly has at least a bachelor's degree. So this is a highly educated, every single person in that room is highly educated, you know, individuals who make their living doing important work in whatever area that they work in.
Mm-hmm.
And yet still, the white supremacy is seeped into their organization to the point that, you know, in the history of Amnesty International USA, the first and only time that they have had observers in this country was in Ferguson this summer, ever.
Mm-hmm.
So you, as an organization that claims to be about human rights, have turned a blind eye for a century to human rights in your own country.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's okay to say, oh, those people are the problem. But when it's a problem that comes back to your doorstep, you don't want to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's where it's like, you know, I think the legislative piece is important, but there's so much that has to be broken down, you know. And there's people, you know, I talk to people all the time. Philip Agnew, who runs the Dream Defenders, I heard him talking the other day. I mean, he's very radical dude. Like, he wants to create separate states. We're going to make our own food. He wants to get the fuck out of this shit and doesn't want anything to do with white supremacy and this white systems that have allowed it to be created. And, you know, there's a lot of people that think that way. I say all the time, like, you know, if I had my...
That's what happened in Canada. That's what I mean. It's funny you say that, because with the First Nations in the La Baie James, which is kind of like the northern part of Quebec province, they did that in the 70s. They're like, this is fucking bullshit.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is our land and we're going to claim it and we're going to fight for it and we're going to just live amongst our... like just our culture, our kids are going to learn the culture and just everything like that. That's what they fought for. Like, is that maybe it's radical, but maybe that could be a wake up call. to say okay.
Mm-hmm. Well, it needs to be in the conversation, honestly. Mm. Everything needs to be on the table because the reality is, and I think that this is when we talk about like the baby boomer generation and how they didn't really talk to like Gen X or millennials about issues of race as much. It's largely because I think it's just timing, honestly, because you think about what Leslie pointed to as far as it being so much better to them compared to what they went through. You look at the same thing happened right after the end of slavery, mm-hmm. where people weren't taught about these things because, you know, they figured it was better than what they had gone through before. Mm-hmm. And the reality is no, they were just locking niggas up and making them slaves anyway. Mm. White supremacy is adjusted every time we've made progress. And the reason being is because we let up. We get comfortable, honestly.
Yeah.
I am vehemently against making the oppressed responsible for stopping their own oppression.
Right.
Like the whole concept of black liberation, I understand, but I support it because of the fact that it's logically an avenue that needs to be explored. But the reality is what should happen is white people should just stop fucking oppressing black people. White supremacy should just stop. Like, that's what should happen. Why is that so hard to understand for people?
Mm-hmm. Historically, I'm telling you.
It's because the people in power don't see it.
They don't see it. Nature, something has to force them to see it.
Yeah.
And I think it could be things like a shift of population. If more minorities get, you know, if the percentage of minorities of young people starts increasing and then you see white people, their young numbers are going down, things like that is probably going to make them go, oh, shit.
Yeah, I mean, and definitely, certainly there's always this talk about the browning of you know, the world and certainly this country. But what happens is that they just inaugurate more people into whiteness. They're in the process of inaugurating Latinos into whiteness right now, and they're pressing really hard to make that happen, mm-hmm. which is causing a lot of strife within the Latin community because there's a lot of black people that are Afro-Hispanics and Afro-Latinos who are being completely shut out of their identity because of anti-blackness, which is a global phenomenon. My issue, though, is I don't know if they don't see it. I actually don't concede that point because I do think they see it. But the reality is that most white people actually believe that they're better than non-white people.
Yeah, they've been taught
that from the moment they open their eyes until whatever last breath that they draw. And so
the world they live in reinforces that.
And everything tells them that they're right in that. So it's not that they don't see it. They see it because if these same things were happening to their people, they would see it. And they will understand, but they don't care. They think we deserve this. That's why you see the same fucking trope come out. Oh, somebody got killed. This man that just was found hanging in Mississippi in a tree a couple weeks ago.
Yeah,
when
yeah.
you see
and all suicide.
These, and all
when
these
you see
laws,
the media, they, when you see the first picture I saw of this man on a news media outlet was his fucking mugshot. He's dead. That's it. And somebody, this white dude actually came in my goddamn mentions on Twitter to tell me that, they had to get it up quickly. That was probably the only thing that they could find. I said, you mean to tell me that's the only picture of this man on earth? Are they not a global news organization? The fuck are you talking about right now? But it's white supremacy and his actual belief that there wouldn't be anything other than that to show of this man. Mm-hmm. That would allow him to think that and then come on my mentions and need to tell me about it.
Yeah, most white people don't recognize that the laws they think hold true for everybody had to pass through so many white filters that it just evolves into being catered for them.
Mm-hmm. The Civil Rights Act, the Voting Rights Act. Mm-hmm. Those are perfect examples. Honestly. But
white people don't see that. You know, white people see it as like these rules apply to everybody.
Yeah, it's a just world fallacy that they have. They think that everything is just because it's just for them. I will say that I get that and I do agree that that is true. But I think the bigger issue is them not being willing to confront their actual belief systems, because they're used to feeling good about themselves. And so anything that confronts that feeling, they're not here for it. They've never had to contemplate that they're not as good as they think they are. So I don't mean good at stuff. I mean good like a good person. You hear them say that all the time. These fucking frat boys. You don't know his heart. He's such a good person. Man, fuck you. I don't give a shit what kind of person you are. It doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm. That doesn't absolve you.
It does not mean anything to me. I don't care.
You can make an argument that needs to be considered with your actions, but that doesn't absolve your actions completely, period. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you can be a good person and be racist as fuck. My grandfather, good person, misogynistic as fuck.
Right.
Like, mm-hmm. We get it. It's not like no one said you weren't a good person. We said you were being fucking racist. Mm-hmm. Like, those two are not mutually exclusive.
Exactly. They can be both in the same. You know what I mean? Like, you can get labeled both of those.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And both of them be absolutely accurate.
Exactly. Yeah, 100% accurate on both sides.
That's why it's so frustrating. I was just saying that I was talking about that to Clove a couple of weeks ago. I get frustrated reading the news because...
It was right around the time I got a black eye.
Shush, Clove, shut up.
It's not me, it's the dean.
It's the dean. I was just joking, by the way, when I said Clove, shut up. I don't talk to Clove like that.
Mostly.
Stop it. I get frustrated because, I don't know, I was just saying to Clove, it's so, you know, this the way they write articles, and I know I've mentioned this on our show, and how they really, there's this, it's like, I always like to read between the lines. It's like, why are you pushing on examples of Mike Brown, or even like this gentleman that you just recently shared, Floyd, is it? How they'll point out things in an article like black 57 Floyd so and so, while white, you know, two cops who happens to be white and stuff like that. And I'm thinking to myself, wait a second. The majority is writing these articles, but then they're going to go on fucking MSNBC or Fox or CNN and say, whoa, why is black people got to make it race? We're not making it race. You're fucking writing it. You're the one who's like the majority who's writing in the media. You're the one who I just feel like.
They don't even realize they're perpetuating
it. Yeah. Why aren't you writing it to be even? Why aren't you writing it in a way to educate your people who are white, who are the majority, to look at it in a way like, look, man, let's look past the whole fucking color thing. This is fucking bullshit that a man who just happens to put his hands in his pocket or who is unarmed is getting shot or beat up, or a kid who's like a college student minding his own business. Like, why are you writing the news the way that you are?
Yeah.
Just to victimize or make the minority look a certain way in order to make it okay for white folks to be like, oh, look again, it's another race thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know what? Honestly, I think that there's a large place for that in the media. But we also have to look at the fact that if these things, if race isn't accounted for, we have no way of accounting for the disproportionate treatment. And then we end up having this feeling like, well, maybe it's just me, or he could be feeling, well, maybe that's just him, or maybe that's just this doesn't happen so much to black people, it happens to everyone. And then people negate the fact that, yes, this also has to do with race. It has very much to do with police brutality and but it is aggravated by racism and by white supremacy. You know, I call it the Negro multiplier effect.
That's true.
Because if you, in all honesty, if you stop these types of interactions with American citizens, regardless of race, if you stopped these types of interactions, the fact that he got pulled over for fucking a rolling stop late at night when there's no one else there, it's very clear, that should have never happened. And you know what? If those types of things don't happen, then yeah, it's going to disproportionately help black people because we're disproportionately at risk for these things happening. But it still doesn't take away from the racism that that officer has any time that he has an interaction with a black person, whether that officer be black, white, Latino. I mean, we've seen that with the DOJ report.
That just floors me, though, mm-hmm. when I see that shit.
I see
a black officer, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing?
White people like to act like their racism, doesn't affect their day-to-day. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, it's just my head hurts.
All right, we're going to end part one of our conversation with Shirley and Clove from Chonilla here. As Clove, as you can hear, has a little bit of a headache. But you can find this podcast at FergusonResponse.org or via iTunes or Stitcher. Just search Ferguson Response if you're looking for actions in your area. To find your city or add your city, go to FergusonResponse.tumblr.com. You can find me on Twitter at Leslie Mack. That's M-A-C. You can find Ricky on Twitter at AUADOT.org or on Facebook at Facebook.com/AUA Movement and on the website AUAMovement.org. And you can look for the Americans United Again Movement app on Google Play and on any Android device. As for Chonilla, you can find them on their website, Chonilla.com. You can also find them at Facebook.com/Chonilla and on Twitter at Chonilla. And you can find Shirley at Sherasaurus and Clove at Clovisaurus. We'll be back with part two of our conversation where we dive deep into the global effects of anti-blackness and talk about some international issues that white supremacy causes. Thanks for joining us.